for oral argument today. It's case number A22-725 in the matter of the welfare of the children of KW and NM. As counsel know, each party has 15 minutes allocated for the principal argument, and an appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. So we have the usual lectern in the middle. We also have two lecterns on the side, and I believe that all three of them are in working order, so you can take your pick. The lights that indicate the time remaining are only in the center lectern, so the yellow light will come on with 5 minutes remaining, and the red light will come on when your time has expired. So anyway, you may take your pick. Counsel for appellant, please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Excuse me. Good morning. May it please the court.
I'll just mention, too, that there is you can may raise or lower that lectern. There's a button directly in the front edge of the some up or down switches. I usually mention that as well. And if you wish to lower it up or down, you may. It's up to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm comfortable if the court can hear me. I'm going to grab my water, though. May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Nicole Groneberg, and I represent the appellant father, N.M., in this matter. The father comes before you today and respectfully requests that this court reverse the order terminating his parental rights to his two children on the finding that the district court abused its discretion in finding that the county met its burden of proving a statutory basis for termination by clear and convincing evidence. And we also ask that you find that the court abused its discretion in finding that terminating the father's parental rights served the best interests of the children in this matter. Would the court like a brief recitation of the facts?
Generally, it's unnecessary. We're usually very familiar with the facts, so I think you can go straight to the legal issues.
Thank you, Your Honor. Notwithstanding the lengthy 5-month trial in this matter, the fact that this underlying CHIPS proceeding lasted for over 4 years. The lengthy order issued by the district court and the lengthy pleadings that accompanied this proceeding. This proceeding is, in fact, fairly straightforward, and the vast majority of the facts in this matter are not disputed by the parties and were not disputed at trial. Simply put, we have a matter where the father, at the beginning of the underlying CHIPS matter, that was the basis for the findings that the district court based its termination on. At the beginning of that CHIPS matter, he was in a state of crisis, and that is undisputed. The father was grappling for the first 2 years of this case with instability, with substance abuse, mental health, housing, homelessness, instability with employment, general life functioning. However, this case did not end 2 years after it began. It went on and ended more than 4 years after Ramsey County became involved with this family at the end of 2017. And for the 2+ years prior to the conclusion of the termination trial, the father's picture in this matter with regard to his engagement in services and his general life functioning was dramatically different than the first 2 years.
Can I stop you there and just, I'd like to ask a question about, one sticking point, I think, in your argument. So I'm looking at the last page of the district court's order where it's discussing best interests, and the district court makes the statement that Mr. McCabe has said on multiple occasions, including as recently as 3 months ago, that he does not want to parent the children full time and is not in a position to do so. How do you respond to that? How do you respond to that statement by the district court and that part of its analysis?
I would say that is one of the few points of fact that were in dispute at trial. Certainly, the father did not state at trial that he did not want to parent his children. In fact, I would submit that the fact that the trial lasted for 5 months, started 5 months, in fact, 6 months prior to when that order was issued, the father is making a pretty clear statement by going forward with the termination trial that he, in fact, did want to parent his children. That finding by the district court, in fact, is in conflict, as far as the timeline is concerned, with the fact that the father had actively engaged in, participated with, and gone forward with that termination trial months prior to when the district court is claiming that statement was made.
And that statement was made to, as Ms. Williamson was the witness who testified to that statement, correct?
That sounds correct, Your Honor. And again, I would just submit that that statement is starkly contradicted by the fact that, and is plainly in error, given the fact that the father was actively proceeding with the termination trial. The father was the first witness called by the county in the trial. And so prior to the court's claim or finding that that statement was credible by the social worker, the father had already testified to the contrary and had continued to proceed with trial even after that statement allegedly had been made. So that is a point of contest with regard to the evidence, but one that we would submit. The finding was clearly an error because the court's own finding is starkly contradicted by the plain action of appellant in engaging with the termination trial and proceeding with the termination trial.
So what I'm struggling with here is the conviction for the sex offense, and the father, your client, wasn't allowed to have unsupervised visits with his child yet. And so, and as you've stressed, this case had gone on for quite a long time. So how do we get around that and say that the termination of parental rights, which had blown past pretty much all the statutory deadlines already, how do we get around that? What's your client's position on that?
Thank you, Your Honor. Our position is that this matter should be reversed and remanded so that the court can be held to its duty to ensure that the proper steps forward are taken in this matter. On June 30th of 2021, the court had in fact ordered that that unsupervised visitation begin. It never did. A safety plan.
My understanding of the record, and you obviously know it much better than I do, was that the father's probation officer would not allow. I mean, so no matter, and I don't see that would not allow unsupervised visits with the children. So where, am I wrong? I mean, which I might be, but that's my understanding of the record. That's where I am really struggling.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think that that was a point that was not, I would submit, not clearly established at trial, which again, that burden falls with the county with regard to what the exact delay was with starting the visitation. My understanding of the record is not that the probation officer would say no or that that was the sticking point as far as the father starting visitation.
So where in the record would you cite for that? Or you're just saying that the county didn't put in clear and convincing evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. I would submit that the record, that there is nowhere in the record where it would be supported that the reason why visitation did not start was because the probation officer was saying that it could not start. I do not believe that the record supports that, although there was a fair amount of, even though the probation officer herself testified, which is where I would ask the court to refer to if looking for a direct statement with regard to whether or not the probation officer herself said, I understand that there's a safety plan, but I'm not supervising it. The probation officer had actually, I'm not giving it the okay. The probation officer actually had approved of the father working with an underage individual already. There was nothing in the record to suggest that the probation officer had any serious or stark concerns about supervised contact between the father.
Oh, I'm not talking about I'm talking about unsupervised
contact.
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. I'm talking about unsupervised. Yeah, okay. No, I know the supervised was actually in place.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
Okay, I misunderstood. Thank you for the clarification. With regard to the unsupervised, in child protection, these cases follow a pretty consistent pattern of progression. And if we can't take that first step to unsupervised, no one is going to necessarily jump to unsupervised. And so our position is we weren't there because we had been stalled out on the unsupervised visitation. I do not believe that the record would support that if there had been, if that unsupervised, or sorry, supervised visitation had commenced in June of 2021 when it was ordered, or several months prior to the conclusion of trial when there was a safety plan created for that supervised visitation. Had that commenced, we could have been sitting in a very different spot at the time that the case concluded as far as the opinions as to whether or not the father could have unsupervised visits. There is testimony, there is not clear testimony, I would say, with regard to, well, strike that. I guess that's what I would suggest, is that we aren't there. That's what we are asking for.
So
is that?
If I may follow up on this, we only need to be able to affirm on one ground, right? And I'm looking at the egregious harm ground. And I think you're agreeing that your client's sex offense constitutes egregious harm under the statute, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why isn't the fact that he committed this sex offense, which is egregious harm, and he still, despite the passage of time you've described, has not completed sex offender treatment? Why aren't those two facts enough to find evidence to support the egregious harm statutory ground for termination?
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate and invite that question because I did want to address this issue of egregious harm. I hear your question as having two parts. And so I'll first address whether or not the act itself should be sufficient to satisfy proof of the egregious harm statute for termination, if that's satisfactory to Your Honor, and then address the issue of not completing the sex offender treatment. What I would submit is that the plain black letter of the law does not state that if you commit an act of egregious harm as defined by statute, that your rights should be terminated, that there is an irrebuttable finding that that statutory ground is met and that your rights shall be terminated. In fact, what the statute states is that in order to terminate based on egregious harm, that action must be one that is of a nature, duration, or chronicity that would indicate a lack of regard for a child's well-being such that a reasonable person would believe it contrary to the best interests of the children or any child to be in the parent's care. That is different than simply committing an act of egregious harm. And what we would submit is the fact that after the father freely, openly acknowledged that he engaged in that misconduct, he took responsibility for it, he admitted to it, he admitted to it in a court of law. He never recanted at any point after admitting it in 2019. He was convicted of that offense and was placed on probation after he acknowledged it, and it was an open fact. The county at that point recognized that he was engaging with his case plan, and they decided to not move forward with a fast-track termination, meaning the only logical conclusion is that they thought it was possible that the father could be safe to have the children in his care. There is no other logical conclusion. And even
wasn't that a little earlier? And then he made what I think was characterized as very slow progress, if progress, in sex offender treatment.
Yes. And so that is the other part of the question that I hear from Your Honor. So I just want to be clear that I think the actions of the county and the action of the court in ordering the supervised visitation June 30th indicate that reasonable minds did think it was possible for him to potentially in the future care for his children. With regard to the slow progress, what I would note is that the court abused its discretion in finding that the evidence presented in that regard was clear and convincing. It was not. The only thing that was clear is that the parties seemed to acknowledge that the father had was still in phase one of treatment. But even the person from Skip Parts that came to testify, who did not ever directly work with the father, she could not really clearly say what he was working on in that first phase. What we do know through the evidence presented is that the father had made notable progress in terms of reducing his risk of reoffense level. That was demonstrated through testing. We also know that the county failed to procure current evidence as of the time of trial to indicate what the father's actual progress was at the time of trial. We don't have that. And so at the time of trial, we didn't have an updated report. The most updated report was an email that was received by the social worker or the guardian, but a recent email to either the social worker or the guardian indicating that the father was engaging with services and coming to the end of completing a workbook, that is not clear and convincing evidence to indicate where his progress actually is. We know he was making progress as far as reducing his risk level. We know he was staying with the program. It can't be easy to stick with a program like that. These are the things we know. We don't know, though, and that's not the father's burden. That is the county's, and it was an abuse of discretion to find that that was proven by clear and convincing evidence. Respectfully, we request that the court reverse the termination in this matter. Thank you.
I have one question for you before you sit down. Just to, if you could clarify, are you challenging the district court's findings of fact? I get the sense you are from your argument so far. I mean, your brief did not specifically identify certain findings that are clearly erroneous. But is that part of your argument that there are clearly erroneous findings of fact in the order?
I will be forthcoming in that I was not anticipating Your Honor's question with regard to that specific finding of fact. I acknowledge.
No, aside from that question, I'm just wondering if, you know, I mean, your brief argues with respect to each of the ultimate findings by the court, the ultimate determinations about the five statutory grounds and best interests, that the district court abused its discretion in reaching those conclusions or those determinations, depending on how you want to characterize them. I'm just wondering if you're also challenging the underlying findings with respect to each, or whether you're accepting the findings of fact in the district court's order and simply challenging the district court's more judgmental decision about whether the statutory criteria have been proved.
So we are staying faithful to the legal question on appeal, given what we submitted in the brief, which is, did the court abuse its discretion in finding that the facts were sufficient to prove the bases for termination? But we are not challenging, we are accepting the findings of fact, given the amendments, and there were a number of significant amendments made following the post-trial motion with regard to the findings of fact. But we are not questioning those findings.
Okay, thank
Otherwise.
You for that clarification.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent, you may approach the lectern and begin. And please identify both yourself and your client.
Thank you, Your Honors. We'll be splitting our time. As counsel for the Ramsey County Social Service Department, I would like 12 minutes, and then reserve 3 minutes for counsel for the guardian ad litem,
Did the guardian ad litem file an appellate brief? Okay. Oh, of course. Yeah, there it is. Okay. Thank you very much. 12 and 3, understood. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Michelle Thompson. I represent the Ramsey County Social Service Department in this appeal before the court today. I do agree with appellant. I believe that this case is very straightforward for the court today. The issue is simply whether for this court is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in finding there were sufficient facts in the record to support the termination of parental rights on five grounds, which the court found, and as this court noted, this court need only affirm one ground. To support the finding that the Ramsey County Social Service Department did provide reasonable efforts to reunify with appellant, and to support that the termination was in the children's best interest. In reviewing this record and affording the district court the appropriate deference for making these determinations, this court will certainly find that the trial court's findings are squarely addressed the statutory criteria and are supported by the record, and as such are not clearly erroneous. As I stated, the trial court found five statutory grounds proven under Minnesota Statute 260C.301. That appellant substantially, continuously, or repeatedly refused or neglected to comply with his parental duties, that appellant is palpably unfit to be a party to the parent-child relationship, that following the children's placement out of the home, reasonable efforts by the agency did not correct the conditions that led to that out-of-home placement, that a child has experienced egregious harm in appellant's care, and that the children are neglected and in foster care. The trial court heard testimony over 13 days and accepted thousands of pages of exhibits that it relied on in its detailed 67-page order to find all of these grounds proven, find reasonable efforts, and find that the termination was in the children's best interest. This case began with appellant not complying with his parental duties. As the record indicates, the child, J.M., who is 3.5 years old, was being abused in his home, both physically and mentally, by mother. Mother was striking J.M. repeatedly with a spatula up to 10 to 12 times, causing bruising, laying on top of him, trying to place him in the refrigerator, trash can, freezer. She had also been hospitalized up to 6 times in the course of the year leading up to Child Protection's involvement. And what brought this case to Child Protection's attention was her intentional drug overdose. Appellant lived with the mother and the children during this time. He was aware of at least some of this abuse. He was aware that JM was afraid of mother, and he was well aware of mother's mental health instability. But appellant did not protect the children from this abuse. Appellant himself, prior to Child Protection's involvement, was very unstable, as has been acknowledged. He engaged in a relationship with the mother that he describes as very unhealthy and where domestic violence was involved. He exposed the children to that violence and abuse. He also exposed the children to sexual activity in the home and used chemicals while caring for the children. Appellant placed the children in dangerous situations with his own actions, as well as his failure to protect the children from mother. Appellant states in his brief that he was not involved in the reasons the children were removed from their parents' care. But if appellant had met his duties as a parent to protect the children, removal would not have been necessary. In fact, Ramsey County Social Services made a safety plan to keep the children at home. And because appellant could not follow that safety plan after a mere number of months, their removal was necessary. Additionally, while parenting the children and in the same household where they all lived, appellant sexually abused a 12-year-old child in his care. Appellant was charged with and pled guilty to that second-degree criminal sexual conduct for touching a 12-year-old child's bare, unclothed, intimate parts and having her masturbate him on multiple occasions. He also continued his sexual abuse of her after she left his care, sending her photos of himself in his underwear in an erect state. Appellant acknowledges that she was a child who needed care and acknowledges that he was in a position to be a role model to her, to his sex offender treatment.
Could, counsel, if I may interrupt you, because we are pretty familiar with these sometimes difficult facts. But as long as we're talking about the sex offense, it really does get to my question on the egregious harm ground. Mm-hmm. Appellant suggests that his progress in sex offender treatment, you know, was enough to you know, not have us be able to affirm that it's not only egregious harm, but it's of the nature and chronicity that's going to indicate the lack of, I think, regard for the child's well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So could you, obviously you're more familiar with this record, which is massive, than we are. Tell us, what was the evidence before the trial court about the appellant's progress in sex offender treatment or lack thereof at the time of trial?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe the trial court certainly had sufficient facts to rely on to find that this met egregious harm, including that nature, duration,
and chronicity. I think
okay. Well, I'll specifically address the sex offender treatment. With regard to the sex offender treatment, the evidence presented to the trial court was from both the probation officer of appellant as well as from a provider at the sex offender treatment facility, Skip Parts. Both of those providers indicated that at the time of trial, at the time of their testimony, that the appellant was only in phase one of a treatment program that is typically three and sometimes four phases. Appellant had been in this treatment program for 22 months at the time this testimony was elicited and had not yet moved on to phase two of treatment. The testimony that was elicited and the trial court relies on and is included in that order indicates that this was in large part due to appellant's poor attendance and progress and engagement in that treatment program. That if appellant had been more engaged, certainly it would have been expected he could have been further along in treatment. Regardless of whether appellant was in phase one or had even perhaps was ready to move to phase two, the fact was that at the time of trial, he certainly had not completed sex offender treatment.
And that was a condition of probation. Is probation correct?
That is correct. As this court was asking appellant's counsel, in terms of that visitation was directly tied to his progress in sex offender treatment. I think the court will find the record was clear by the testimony of both the probation officer and the sex offender treatment provider that they had not yet approved him to even have supervised visits until the time of trial. While the trial court in that June 30th order had indicated that supervised visits could occur, the actual practice of putting those into effect was in the hands of his probation officer and his sex offender therapist and creating a safety plan. And in fact, the children's therapist had also weighed in, indicating that they did not believe the children were ready for contact. So those providers had to come up with that plan, and the record will indicate in their testimony that they testified to that, and that the only thing at the time of trial they were prepared to recommend for appellant was professionally supervised contact with his children. I want to continue addressing, I want to address the first 18 months of the case and the reasonable efforts that the agency did provide. During that first 18 months or so of the case, the agency was in fact required to provide reasonable efforts for a respondent to reunify with his children. The trial court made finding after finding at all of the review hearings and reviewing the agency's oral reports, written reports, and updates that the agency was making that effort. It was appellant who was not engaged with the case. Appellant did not do anything that was asked of him with regard to his case plan and engaging in social services until he provided a urinalysis, which was exactly a year after the case was opened. The large extent of his participation in the case did not actually come until after the termination of parental rights petition was filed, and the agency was relieved of reasonable efforts. That first 18 months of the case, appellant was not in contact with the agency, not in contact with the guardian ad litem, not engaged in his case plan. He was not making efforts himself towards reunifying with his children. The district court found repeatedly that the agency had made efforts to try to engage him, meet with him, try to get him to be involved in that case plan in his children's lives, and appellant did not do so. Agency was then relieved of efforts after that termination of parental rights petition was filed, and the trial court found that there was a prima facie basis for egregious harm. It was then that appellant really began engaging in case plan services. Appellant argues that he today is in a position and wants to parent. However, the facts of this case support the trial court's determination that things are largely unchanged for appellant when it comes to parenting his children. He is, as was previously stated, at the time of trial, only in phase one of 3 to 4 phases of sex offender treatment. His progress in treatment, as stated, was directly tied to his visitation with his children. He had not been able to see his children in approximately 2 years, but that was due to appellant's actions of sexually abusing a child, being convicted and on probation for that sex offense, and then not engaging in his sex offender treatment in a proactive, urgent manner in order to move forward with that. Additionally, while he did complete inpatient treatment and is more stable than he was at the beginning of this case, he continues to lack insight into his chemical dependency and recovery, as well as the children's trauma and his own actions that led to their removal and how he neglected his parental duties at the time the trial court made this order. He is not engaging in any aftercare for his chemical dependency. He continues to engage in relationships with those who he used with, including mother, who was using at the time of trial. He continued to miss urinalysis testing leading up to the time of trial. He had not engaged in mental health therapy, aside from 6 weeks while he was in CD treatment, despite the voluminous records about his mental health struggles and depression and how those continued, and the sex offender therapist noted issues with that ongoing in the case. Instead, appellant's plan he articulated at trial was to wait until he was in acute crisis and utilize crisis services if needed. Additionally, when asked during trial whether he needed parenting classes or education, appellant indicated he did not need them before. Appellant seems to indicate that his parenting of the children before their removal was appropriate and that he did protect them, and the record indicates otherwise. Because of that, I'm sorry, my time is out. I believe the trial court's determination that this was in the children's best interest is well-founded on that record, and we'd ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Counsel for the guardian ad litem, you may begin. Please introduce yourself and your client.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alex Bruzilovsky, and I represent the guardian ad litem in this matter. Given the time that I have today, I will be brief, and I will only address the best interests of the children. And best interests of the children, of course, require that the children be raised by someone who can actually provide appropriate parenting to them. And in this case, despite anything that the father may argue, there is a simple, inescapable fact that cannot be argued with. And the fact is that it cannot be disputed that the father faces an absolute barrier to parenting and that he is prohibited from having contact with minors as a result of his sexual offense against another minor. And if the father is unable to have contact with minors at all, then it is that simple that he cannot provide appropriate parenting for his children. It is true that the father could have contact with minors if so approved by his probation officer, but so far, even after a lengthy period of sex offender treatment, the father had only been able to secure a permission to only see his own children in a supervised setting. And even then, even supervised visits had not yet started at the time of trial, and there was no clear picture as to when they might start. And if it was argued that sometime down the road the father might eventually gain permission to see his children without supervision and so as to be able to parent them, there was still no clear indication as to when and if that might happen, if ever. And the children's best interests clearly dictate that they be given a permanent loving home rather than have to wait an unknown amount of time until the father potentially might gain a permission to see them without supervision. And even if the father somehow or sometime down the road did gain the permission to see his own children without supervision, it is still obvious that he would face absolute barriers to parenting because he would still not be able to have contact with other minors. And it is obvious that parenting oftentimes, and not just oftentimes, that virtually always require coming into contact with other minors. It is obvious the parents oftentimes have to go to school for a wide variety of reasons, and parents need to take their children to all kinds of functions with their peers, from sporting events to birthday parties. And if the father could not be around other children, then he would not be able to perform such basic tasks of parenting, even if he could take his own children into his home. I also want to emphasize a couple of things from the father's testimony. It was clear that he exhibited a lack of basic understanding about how his children would need to be reintroduced to him after a lengthy period of separation. And he didn't understand how cutting his work hours to care for the children would impact his ability to provide for the children financially. And if you look at the entire picture of this case, it is clear that the father is simply unable to care for his children simply because he cannot be around them unsupervised and cannot be around other children unsupervised. And the children deserve permanency and stability rather than endless waiting for the father to potentially gain a permission to parent them sometime down the road.
Mr. Brusilovsky, because your time has expired, could you please summarize and conclude?
Yeah, and I had one last sentence, Your Honor, and I was just going to say that the district court correctly terminated the father's parental rights, and that decision should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Groneberg, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
May it please the court.
Before you begin,
yes.
We should reset the clock to five. There we go. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address this idea that the notion of the father being able to parent his children is some ethereal, far off, children will be waiting forever to have this happen kind of situation. That is not the evidence that was present at trial. We will acknowledge that there was not evidence to demonstrate when exactly the children could return to the father's care. But again, the evidence was not clear and it was not convincing as to how far off that possibility was. Finding that it was an abuse of discretion. And a parent's rights, that fundamental right to parent your own children, should never be denied based on an unclear, unconvincing record. Child Protection Court, the paramount consideration is the best interest of the children. It is not an extended arm of the criminal court. And in some of the arguments that are made, it almost sounds as if that is how this has been approached. Yes, there was an instance of criminal sexual conduct, but no, that is not enough simply on its own to terminate a parent's rights. Counsel for respondent brought up the fact that appellant was largely not compliant with his case plan, not engaged with the case prior to the termination petition being filed based on the egregious harm. We do not dispute that fact, but it is also not a coincidence that his level of engagement and his positioning of himself to parent his children dramatically changed after that termination petition was filed, because that is also when he acknowledged what he had done, started coming to grips with it, and started engaging with real life-changing services. With regard to the fact or the suggestion that it was somehow in response to the termination being filed, or there is no evidence to support that suggestion. And I would
but
note
the co-owner of the sex offender treatment program testified that he hadn't yet addressed his risk factors in therapy and on and on. So why is that not sufficient to just say, yeah, he's trying, but it's not enough and not quickly enough?
Simply put, Your Honor, because we don't know, based on the evidence that was presented, what that means. We don't know if there are, for example, other parents in that program that are permitted to have their children in their care while they engage in phase one, while they continue to address risk factors. We don't know that because that record wasn't presented. What we do know is that the father was staying engaged. These are the things we know. He was staying engaged. He was making progress. But the county failed to present a clear and convincing basis to explain to us what significance it means that he was in phase one versus phase two, whether or not he could start seeing his children in the near future. We don't have that record. I would like to note that the guardian stated, or I'm sorry, counsel for the guardian ad litem stated that as of the close of trial, the father had only been given permission to see his own children in a supervised setting. That is not accurate. The record is clear that as part of the father's work, he worked with underage individuals, and he had permission to do that from his probation officer. There was simply no absolute bar to the father seeing or being around children as long as it was approved by probation. That is a finding that was corrected from the court's initial termination order and the amended findings that were provided on the post-trial motion. Again, the court ordered the visitation in June of 2021. The suggestion that it was only father's lack of progress that prevented him from having that visitation is not accurate. And I meant to bring it up here to read directly the statement from the court order from June of 2021. But in that order, which was admitted as an exhibit at trial, the court did find that based on the father's progress in treatment, acknowledged progress by his sex offender treatment providers, this is why there should be visitation. And that was June of 2021. The termination trial concluded in late February of 2022. The father respectfully comes before the court and asks that you reverse the termination of his parental rights to his two children. The record presented at trial was not clear, it was not convincing, it was not nearly enough to support denial of the fundamental right of the father to parent his children and the right of the children to be parented by their natural parent if possible. It is not in their best interest to have their father cut out of their lives permanently, as he had done so much work to position himself to parent for 2 years and demonstrate stability. We ask that this court find that the district court abused its discretion in finding that the record was clear and convincing and supported a statutory basis for termination, and that the district court abused its discretion in finding that that termination served the best interests of the children in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within the time required by law, which for this type of case is 45 days. Thank you.